From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Each week at this time on Fresh Air, we feature interviews from our archives. On today's Fresh Air, we have a couple of recent interviews that were preempted in many cities by a press conference and confirmation hearings. Nancy Mayers is a Catholic and a feminist. We'll discuss her new memoir, Ordinary Time. She describes it as the story of how one woman deals with God's presence day after day. Earlier this month, the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue tried to stop abortions in seven cities across the United States. We'll hear from the group's founder, Randall Terry. Abortion isn't his only issue. He has an agenda for a Christian nation. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Zooropa, the new album by U2. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Bosnia's three warring factions today appear to have made some progress toward ending a 16-month civil war. The three sides have struck a deal that would divide the republic into three parts, but the new borders still have to be negotiated. United Nations officials are closely following discussions in Washington and other capitals on adopting a more vigorous use of force in Bosnia. Officials are particularly interested in any talk of enhanced air power. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
As the Clinton administration seeks British and French agreement to use military force to stop the Bosnian Serb assault of Sarajevo, UN officials are assessing its potential impact on current peacekeeping operations. As well, they're studying suggestions to fully implement a resolution that would allow for NATO airstrikes to be used in order to deliver humanitarian relief. Today, UN spokesman Joseph Sills again sounded a note of caution.
We don't want to operationalize mandates in such a way that they spread the warfare and kill more people and create more damage than they solve.
One diplomat described the current debate on enhanced military action as a situation in which a large foot is on the accelerator, while an equally large foot is on the brake. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Administration officials and congressional leaders have reached agreement on a gas tax increase of 4.3 cents a gallon, but negotiators still must settle remaining pieces of the plan, which fell short of the president's $500 billion deficit reduction target. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Members have been in and out of meetings all day, working on the details of the final package. Budget Committee Chairman James Sasser says it's all down to the minutiae. Sasser says there are no major obstacles left to clear now that all sides have agreed to the 4.3 cent gas tax increase. Black and Hispanic leaders were concerned that their programs were threatened by the lower-than-expected tax increase, but House Speaker Tom Foley said he assured them he would stand firm. Foley was not prepared, however, to say the package was a done deal.
There's a standard rule in all budget talks, which I used to repeat like a mantra. Nothing is agreed to until everything is agreed to.
Some members predict deliberations will occur through the weekend. Congressional leaders hope to vote on the plan next week before the August recess. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
A Senate committee today unanimously passed a $4.7 billion flood relief bill for the Midwest. The measure will now go to the full Senate and then, if passed, back to the House, which approved a $3 billion version on Tuesday. Oil prices eased today on new signs that supplies are up, even after a week when market fears of an imminent return of Iraqi exports died down. And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 27 points to close at 3539.47. You're listening to NPR News. Former Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega lashed out today at the U.S. Senate for its decision to suspend aid to Nicaragua. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
Interviewed here by a local radio station, Ortega accused the U.S. Senate of preparing the ground for sending in United Nations peacekeeping forces to Nicaragua. The Senate decided Wednesday to suspend more than $100 million in aid to Nicaragua until it's certain the government of President Violeta Chamorro is not harboring terrorists. Nicaraguan passports were found in the possession of a suspect linked to the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York last February. Ortega claimed the real reason for the aid suspension, which the House of Representatives has not yet approved, is to curtail the Sandinista political movement he now heads. Many believe President Chamorro has given the Sandinistas too much power in her government. Ortega also criticized the Nicaraguan army, headed by his brother Humberto, for killing 45 renegades who tried to seize the northern town of Esteli last week. I'm David Wellner in Mexico City.
President Clinton today heard from 111 House members urging him to cut American arms sales, especially to developing nations. Democratic Congressman Howard Berman of California is one of the authors of the bipartisan appeal. He pointed out that the United States supplies almost 60% of the weapons in the world. He said American troops who fought in Panama, the Gulf War, and Somalia faced weapons sold or bankrolled by the United States. Senate Democrats today worked out a deal with Republicans which ended a week-long GOP filibuster on President Clinton's college aid plan. The compromise means that the administration's proposal to allow students to earn college tuition money for public service may now come to a vote. House and Senate negotiators reached agreement today on the Clinton administration's direct student loan program. The phase-in plan would allow the government to make at least half of the loans by 1996. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Once a week on our show, we're featuring interviews from our archives. Today, we've selected an interview that a lot of listeners missed because it was preempted on many stations by last week's presidential press conference. As a Catholic and feminist, Nancy Mares knows she set herself up for some spiritual, social, and intellectual dilemmas. She writes about some of them in her new memoir, Ordinary Time. She describes her book as a 20th-century version of the spiritual autobiographies undertaken by her Puritan foremothers, aimed at harmonizing the divine, the secular, and the personal. Faith has not relieved her of pain and inner torment. Mares suffers from multiple sclerosis. She's been an agoraphobic and has been suicidally depressed. When she was writing her memoir, her husband was getting chemotherapy treatments for cancer. Ordinary Time is Mares' fourth book. Writer Francine Prose described this new memoir as a small miracle of honesty mediated by dignity and humor. I asked Nancy Mares to begin with a reading from the opening of Ordinary Time.
Hear, Grace. You will love me, my husband asks, and at something in his tone my consciousness rouses like a startled cat, ears pricked, pupils round and onyx black. Never voluble, he has been unusually subdued this evening. Thinking him depressed about the mysterious symptoms that have plagued him for months, and that we know in our heart of hearts, signal a recurrence of cancer, although the tests won't confirm it for several more days. I pressed up against him on the couch and whispered against his neck, "This may be the most troublesome time of our lives, but I'm so happy." This awareness of joy, though it's been growing for several years now, has recently expanded in response to my own failing health. A few weeks ago, pondering the possibility that I might die at any moment, I posed myself a new question. If I died at this very moment, would I die happy? And the answer burst out without hesitation, yes. Since then, in spite of my fears, I've felt a new contentment. What more could I ever ask than to give an unequivocal response to such a question? His silence persisted. Scared, I asked him after a few moments, thinking of the doctor's appointment that morning, the CAT scan scheduled for later in the week. Head resting on the back of the couch, eyes closed, he nodded. More silence. Finally, I said, "George, you know how I love words. I need words." And now, words. "You will love me." Behind his glasses, his eyes have the startled look I associate incongruously with the moment of orgasm. "Yes," I tell him, alert, icy all over. "I can safely promise you that. I will always love you." "You asked the other day whether my illness could be AIDS," he said unevenly. "I'm pretty sure it isn't, because I had the test for HIV some time ago, after I had an affair for a couple of years with another woman." The sensation is absolutely nonverbal, but everybody knows it even without words. the stunned breathlessness that follows a jab to the solar plexus. What will astonish me in the days to come is that this sensation can sustain itself long after one would expect to be dead of asphyxiation. I have often wished myself dead. If it were possible to die of grief, I would die at this moment. But it's not, and I don't. A couple of years. A couple of years. This was no fit of passion, no passing fancy, but a sustained commitment. He loved her, loves her still. Their relationship, until he broke it off, for reasons having little to do with me, was a kind of marriage, he says. Time after time after time he went to her, deliberately, telling whatever lies he needed to free himself from me and the children, and later from his mother when she came for a protracted visit after his father's death, throughout at least a couple of years.
Thank you for reading that, Nancy. It's Nancy Mayer's reading from her new memoir, Ordinary Time. When I started reading this passage, I thought it was going to be about another person who grows more loving and virtuous every day after being struck with catastrophe. And the affair really threw me. Of course, it felt like real life. And I was wondering why you started a spiritual autobiography with a story about your husband's affair.
I think that's where spiritual life really begins, is in the very earthy and often painful realities of our lives. We don't develop a spiritual life and then fit in what happens to us. The spiritual life grows out of crisis, I think. And so I began where I felt that such life develops.
Of course, as a Catholic, you believe in forgiveness. What did you think of forgiving your husband for this affair?
What surprised me was that when I talked with a priest who asked if I could ever do so, I discovered that I already had. Although I'd never had to confront the issue explicitly, I can think all the way back to college with my roommate saying, boy, if some guy ever cheated on me, that'd be the last time he ever saw me. And I said, I don't think I would respond that way. And all those years later, 30 years later, I got put to the test, and I guess in my own eyes, I passed.
Why didn't you respond that way?
I think that relationships in my life, the ones that I want to cling to, are more important than anything else. I was 4 and a half when my father died, and so I never had very much of a relationship with him. But it made for me, you know, keeping the people I loved about the most important thing in the world.
When you hear a confession like this, it kind of casts that whole period of your life into a different light. I mean, throughout those 2 years of the affair, things weren't what you thought they were. Did you find yourself replaying the film of your life from those 2 years and reinterpreting the whole thing?
Yes, over and over and over again. One of the things that haunted me the most, I have asked him time and again, and he doesn't, either can't or won't answer, was, what did I believe? What did you tell me when you were going to her that I believed and I just let you go? That haunts me, that I believed everything he told me all the way along, and he told me all those lies. For some reason, that's more important to me than the actual sexual transgression.
Mm-hmm.
Is the lack of faith between us during that period.
In an earlier essay, you wrote, "Dismayingly few marriages survive the multiple sclerosis test, and why should they?" Did you feel that this was part of the test in a way that well, it's because you have MS that he was cheating on you?
I have long felt amazed that he would even stay. Self-image is a real problem with a chronic progressive disease, and I think, you know, I'm a horrible failing cripple, and why doesn't he go get a good, healthy woman So I think I did justify his action in those terms. And he justified it to himself also. That's one of the things he tells me, is that part of the reason he did this was because of my MS. And yet he didn't leave. It was as though if he had someplace to retreat to from it for a while, he was willing to come back.
Your husband has cancer.
He does, yes.
So he's in the position now of needing care himself. Do you think...
He is, although at the moment we're enjoying a truly miraculous remission.
Good.
And so he has gone back to being my caregiver with no difficulty. He's feeling physically strong and able. But, of course, we live under that shadow, knowing that at some point he will not be able to continue doing this. And I mind terribly the fact that I will not be able to give him any physical care at all. I really can scarcely move. And I have to work on myself, and he helps me in this, to remember that there are other kinds of care than physical. And I hope to God that I'll be available for those. I have been, and I hope I still have the courage to do it when I have to.
Do you ever feel like you're living out some kind of story of Job, you know? that you've just been hit with too much?
Yes, I do. I sometimes think, you know, it's really not very fair to give the family that has MS in it the melanoma too. And I have a little passage in Ordinary Time where I talk about what I would do if I were God. I wouldn't do this sort of thing. But there are all kinds of terrible things that I would do. So it's just as well I'm not God. I will just go on being Nancy. And to be serious now, I've been facetious, but to be serious, I do not at all see these as the hand of God, punishment or anything like that. I see what's happened to us as random happenings. Perhaps like winning the lottery, only nowhere near as much fun. In other words, I don't believe in a fair universe at all.
Right after you found out about your affair, your husband was sick and would really need your comfort and support. And did you feel like, well, yeah, I'm going to give that to you now after what you did to me?
No, but I did think about giving it to Sandra, his ex-lover. I did think to myself, well, how come she got the sex and I get the death? We'll see how good she is at the bedside. You know, I had those cynical feelings. But in fact, no, I was just so grateful, Terry, to have him for as long as I could keep him, that I really didn't feel that way. I just wanted him to stay. He was dying of cancer. And he could do anything, as far as I was concerned, if he just would stay. And he has for a couple of years now. All sweet borrowed time. I'm grateful for that.
My guest is Nancy Mears. Her new memoir is called Ordinary Time. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Nancy Mears. I believe you were in your 20s when you converted to Catholicism.
In my 30s.
In your 30s.
Were
friends and family baffled at not only your conversion, but at your religion? I mean, did you find that a lot of people couldn't understand how you could be religious? Did they feel that it kind of went against your intellectualism?
Yes, I certainly think that a lot of people still can say, Nancy Mears is so intelligent. How could she also believe this mumbo-jumbo? In fact, I just had a letter from my step-grandmother asking precisely that question, or rather saying with some relief, I'm so glad that I've read your book now and understand that you don't believe all that mumbo-jumbo. Mine is a very intellectualized Catholicism, I think, in that I do think about it all the time. I don't just mindlessly follow it along.
You were brought up a Congregationalist. Why did you convert to Catholicism?
Well, I can't think of anything more different from Congregationalism, so perhaps we could put it down to some sort of rebellion. I don't think so, though. I think a lot had to do with my life experiences, and I talk in the book about both the aesthetic ones. I studied a lot of art and music and literature, in which Catholicism has had a great hand. And also, I became increasingly involved in social justice issues. And the community that I'm affiliated with in Tucson, we are all deeply involved in that. And so I was sort of called into that community by their commitment to sanctuary, work with Central American refugees, and other similar issues. We do a lot of work with the homeless.
Once when you were in church and you were feeling very bad physically, you prayed to God and you said, "Dear God, please heal me." And then you heard a voice.
I did, although it's not like hearing a voice from the outside. These words simply formed in my consciousness. "But I am." That was the response to my prayer to be healed.
As in, "But I am healing you?"
"But I am healing you," yes. And so, as I say in the book, I've been stuck ever since with trying to plumb that prayer and its response. How someone as devastated by a neurological degenerative disease can be being healed, maybe not even in spite of that, but in part through that experience. That's a great puzzle to me.
In your writing over the years, you've been very honest about your suicidal depressions, your multiple sclerosis, and agoraphobia. And you know, you've written about this in detail. You also once wrote a piece on the literature of personal disaster. Do you see your writing as falling into that category?
Yes, the piece that I wrote about this said, you know, that I call it literature of personal disaster, only half facetiously. So I'm a little having my tongue in my cheek when I use it. But I do find that a large number of books are published out of people's experience of pain, sorrow, suffering. And the surprising thing about that is that those are certainly qualities subject to enormous sentimentality and even bathos. But a surprising number of these books are really awfully good as books, as pieces of literature.
What do you think separates the really good literature about personal suffering from the, I don't know, more voyeuristic or sentimental books of its kind?
For me, it has a lot to do with language and the capacity to use language in ways that distinguish one's experience from other people's, so that you get a kind of combination going of identification. The reader can identify because all readers have sorrows and pains of their own. And yet the reader is excited by the very individuality of the voice talking about these common experiences. So that someone like, I use Mae Sarton as an example in that essay that you refer to. One doesn't read Mae in order to hear an 80-year-old woman complain. One reads Mae because she creates a wonderful atmosphere. And it happens that that atmosphere is now being created by a suffering 80-year-old woman.
Do you read a lot of books about people's personal suffering?
I read a lot of books about all kinds of things, and for that reason, and the fact that I don't have much time, generally my reading of books about personal suffering is confined to professional activities. That is, I'm about to review a book for the Washington Post that deals with a woman's husband's death. And I'm sure that they got in touch with me because I've developed a kind of expertise in these matters.
Yeah, the queen of personal suffering.
Right. The connoisseur of catastrophe, I think I've called myself. Sometimes I would like, of course, to shake that off and free myself of it. And in fact, I review off and on for the New York Times, for instance, and they are good about not typing me narrowly, but about giving me a range of books to look at.
I think that pop culture has, in a way, become obsessed with suffering. You know, like the movie of the week is always about somebody's cancer or miscarriage or, you know, the murder of their teenage daughter or something. And, you know, I think a lot of the talk shows are obsessed with it also. And
Horribly.
Yeah. And is it snobbish of me to say, well, I really enjoy the really good, well-written literature on the subject, but a lot of this stuff just strikes me as cheap and voyeuristic, and why are we so obsessed with it? What are your thoughts about why our culture is so obsessed with it, not just the best of its kind, but the real cheap stuff, too?
And in fact, I think they prefer the real cheap stuff because it tends to be cast into clichés.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, that's sort of formulaic. You don't have to have a direct experience with a cliché. It's a formula that everybody has sort of generally agreed on, but you don't have to really apply it deeply to your own life.
You won't be challenged in any way. It won't contradict what you think you're supposed to feel.
That's right. That's right. And so I would suggest to you that such things as those television movies and those talk shows are, in fact, a means for people to distance themselves from suffering, to pretend that it's really not so bad, that it can be, this is one I really hate, if you work hard enough, you can do anything you want to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I could work from now till doomsday, and I will never stand and walk again. And I want to. Oh, I can't tell you, Terry, how I want to get up and walk. And that's a terrible thing to do to people, to give them that message. But that's one of the clichés. And as long as you can stand up and walk, you can mow that cliché, and it will seem to keep my disaster at a distance from you. If this happened to me, you can say, I would want to walk so badly I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that actually those things are doing a real injustice to people with disabilities and to the general population in making them not experience genuine human suffering and loss and discovering the dimensions of those experiences that are transcendent.
How is your health now?
My general health isn't bad at all, but I get weaker and weaker and weaker, so that I'm definitely looking at a time when I really can't move or perhaps even feed myself. One of my great concerns, of course, has been whether I could touch the keyboard and continue to write.
Right.
And that has been resolved by a gift from an anonymous donor of software that will enable me to speak my words and have them pop up on the computer screen.
That's great.
Voice-activated software.
That's great.
So I'm hoping that I can continue to write at least for a while longer.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm so glad I had the chance. Thank you.
Nancy Mayer's new memoir is called Ordinary Time. This was a rebroadcast of an interview that was preempted on many stations last week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Randall Terry, founder of the militant anti-abortion group Operation Rescue, about the group's tactics and his vision for a Christian nation. We're featuring it as part of our weekly edition of Interviews from the Archives. This is a recent interview that many listeners missed because it was preempted on many stations by confirmation hearings. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Zooropa, the new album by U2. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, a week-long deadlock over a national service plan that would allow young people to earn college tuition by performing community service jobs has been broken in the Senate. NPR's Claudio Sanchez has more on the story.
Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania was one of a handful of Republicans who broke ranks to support a three-year, $1.5 billion national service plan.
I favor that funding, although many on this side of the aisle do not. But I believe that that figure has to be justified, especially at a time of a $4 trillion national deficit and the time we are about to soak all Americans with more taxes.
Clinton administration officials say 20,000 people will now be able to sign up for 2 years of service beginning in 1994. They'll work for minimum wage, teaching, cleaning up the environment, or working in health and social service-related jobs. For each year of service, participants will get a $5,000 tuition voucher to attend college. The bill is expected to be approved by the Senate next Tuesday. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
Also on Capitol Hill, a Senate committee has approved $4.7 billion in aid to flood-damaged Midwestern states. The House has approved a $3 billion aid bill. Under the plan approved by the Senate Appropriations Committee, $2 billion would go toward disaster relief efforts and $1.35 billion for crop losses. More than $4 million would go for work on highways, bridges, and levees. Rain that's been falling in Iowa, Nebraska, and northern Missouri is now swelling river currents in St. Louis. The National Weather Service has again revised predictions of when the Mississippi River will crest there. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
The latest prediction raises the river level by a foot since yesterday and moves up the crest by a day. The Mississippi is now expected to reach its high point in St. Louis at 49 feet on Monday. That's 19 feet above flood level. The new figure leaves the city's flood wall just 3 feet of breathing room. What looked like plenty of protection 2 weeks ago seems shorter today. Crews are still working to shore up part of a concrete flood wall in the north part of the city. Water had been coming in underneath the wall because of a 4-foot hole. After the Missouri River raised 2 feet overnight, 450 prisoners are being evacuated from two institutions in suburban St. Louis as a precaution. The Missouri and Mississippi rivers are both expected to come up another 2 feet over the weekend. I'm Kathy Lohr in St. Louis.
Italy has announced it's sending aid to Beirut for refugees fleeing north in the wake of Israeli attacks. A plane load of medical supplies will be sent to Lebanon. Lebanese officials have called for outside help in dealing with a large number of refugees leaving southern Lebanon. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 28 points to close at 3,539.47 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. A Senate committee has approved the nomination of Dr. Joyce Lynn Elders as U.S. Surgeon General. The vote in committee was 13-4, with three Republicans joining all Democrats on the panel to approve the nomination. Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy said that he will push for a final vote in the bill next week before Congress goes into recess. Opposition lawmakers have questioned Elders' support for sex education, abortion rights, and some of her financial dealings. She has been state health director in Arkansas. The Senate Armed Services Committee has endorsed the recommendations of the Base Closure Commission to shut down some 130 facilities around the country. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The panel, acting on a voice vote, agreed to accept the commission's decision to close military installations in South Carolina, Michigan, and California, effectively killing tens of thousands of jobs. Until now, cuts in defense spending have meant reductions in troop levels, ships, tanks, and aircraft. Committee Chairman Sam Nunn said without slashing the number of facilities and scaling back another 45, the military's readiness would be jeopardized. Among those voting to close the bases were Virginia Senators John Warner and Chuck Robb, whose home state will lose several major installations. The only audible no vote came from South Carolina Republican Strom Thurmond. South Carolina will lose the Charleston Naval Shipyard and Naval Station, with job losses estimated at 50,000. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The State Department says that Secretary of State Warren Christopher will leave sometime this weekend for the Middle East, although the exact timing has not been decided. Officials say that Christopher might stop over in Europe on his way to the Middle East to talk about the situation in Bosnia. Christopher has been in high-level consultations this week on both the Middle East and the fighting in Bosnia with European and Middle Eastern leaders. Trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against the German mark and fell against the Japanese yen. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Once a week on our show, we're featuring interviews from our archives. We've selected an interview with Randall Terry because it was preempted on many stations by last week's confirmation hearings. Randall Terry is the founder of the militant anti-abortion group Operation Rescue. Earlier this month, the group held a seven-city, week-and-a-half-long campaign called Cities of Refuge. Their goal was to stop abortions in Philadelphia, Cleveland, Minneapolis, Dallas-Fort Worth, San Jose, Melbourne, and Jackson. Operation Rescue claimed success, but so did abortion rights groups, which were able to keep most clinics open. At many of the demonstrations, there were far fewer anti-abortion activists than expected. Randall Terry organized Operation Rescue in 1986 in Binghamton, New York, where he lives. I spoke with him last week from a studio in Binghamton where he hosts a Christian radio show. Operation Rescue has been targeting individual medical workers as well as clinics. I asked him if this was a recent tactic.
It's recent in the sense of about 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
We determined over 2 years ago that the child killer himself, the abortionist, the physician, that they are the weak link. And let's face it, a man goes to medical school, a woman goes to medical school for all those years. He wants to be respected in his community. He doesn't want to be seen as a murderer who's paying for his nice house with blood money. So when we go into a neighborhood, say, and do residential picketing, which is perfectly constitutional under Frisbee v. Schultz, we're exposing these abortionists, and many of them quit. They say, look, I don't want this bad publicity. I don't want my neighbors to think of me as an abortionist. So they bow out, and they return to the practice of medicine. This has worked for literally scores of abortionists around the country, and we're going to keep using the tactic.
Well, some of them quit out of fear because they feel that their lives are in jeopardy or that their children are being harassed.
Well, first of all, for them to say they feel their lives are in jeopardy, I think is either a lie or it's the delusion that is brought on someone who kills for a living. I mean, paranoia is a real state of mind, even if the thing that someone is afraid of isn't real. So I have no doubt that some of these doctors are paranoid, but the reason they're paranoid is because they are haunted by their own conscience. They know that they have murdered for a living, and they're afraid that someone is going to take their life. Although, obviously, the pro-life movement, with the horrifying exception of David Gunn, the pro-life movement is a movement of nonviolence.
Well, you're saying these people are paranoid, but as you mentioned, David Gunn was murdered just a few months ago because he performed abortions.
And, that's correct, but...
And just one more thing, that many of the medical workers who are getting personally harassed are getting phone calls threatening their lives or threatening the lives of their children. I mean, that could be a very frightening thing. Do you...
I absolutely reject those tactics. I don't doubt that there are some fringe people that do them, Terry, but I cannot control every person in the world, just like... There are elements in the pro-abortion movement who have beaten pro-lifers many times. We have film of pro-lifers being punched in the face, kicked in the face, spit on, bitten by pro-abortion activists, many of whom are homosexuals, and yet the violence against us, of course, is not getting national media attention because we're not politically correct and because the media, by and large, just doesn't side with us. So... We deplore this kind of violence on both sides, and frankly, their side has been 10 times as violent as our side.
Randall Terry, you have a new book called Why Does a Nice Guy Like Me Keep Getting Thrown in Jail?
And in the book, you make it clear that abortion is just one component of your struggle. You write, "Let me say it clearly, we want a Christian nation. There are only two sides, those who hold their ethical allegiance to the Ten Commandments and those who don't. The question is, whose God and whose God's law will dominate this culture?" Where would you fit abortion in your kind of larger menu of issues?
Well, abortion is murder. And up until the late 60s, abortion was a criminal act in this country, punishable by fine and imprisonment, as well it should be. Let me make one thing clear, Terry. When I talk about a Christian nation, I'm not saying that by law everyone must be a Christian or go to church or take communion or anything like that. What I'm saying is that our ethical foundation for our cultural norms and our civic laws must be the Judeo-Christian ethics of the Bible, the Ten Commandments. Don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't perjure, honor your mother and father, don't blaspheme. These are the commandments upon which a civilized society must be built. Because if we don't have those things, then we're going to have the Ted Kennedys and the Barney Franks and the Bob Packwoods and the Bills and the Hillarys leading our nation into moral anarchy and ultimately destruction.
So let me ask you what your goals are besides outlawing abortion.
You pick the arena. Schooling, we would want parents to be able to have the right to choose where to put their kids. We want Planned Parenthood to be completely obliterated, them and their homosexual recruiting friends. We don't want kids having condoms distributed in school. We want children to be taught abstinence before marriage and fidelity afterwards. Homosexuals will get no special privileges, but the perverse acts of sex between men and men or women and women will continue to be criminal offenses. We will not have the messianic state funding every little person who whines that they have a special need or a special interest. People will be required to provide for their own, and it'll be the churches and the communities that help people who are in need, not the government. We won't continue to bail out every bad business decision, like the banks, because it only promotes more irresponsibility in business. In other words, let me cut right to the chase. We believe there's one Savior. His name is Jesus Christ. It is not Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam is not the great Savior, the great healer, the great deliverer, the great food producer. We want individual freedoms. We want the government to stay out of our lives, except that we want the government to prohibit acts of wickedness.
Let me ask you, in your view of a Christian nation, would there be birth control?
Well, if we're talking about the pill or the IUD, absolutely not, because those are abortifacients. The pill should have been outlawed a long time ago because of its link with cervical cancer, uterine cancer, breast cancer, and complications in little girls that were born. If you are talking about two adults involved in using a condom, then that's up to them.
My guest is Randall Terry, founder of the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Randall Terry, founder of Operation Rescue. You have been saying that the floods that have devastated so much of America were God's judgment, God's wrath, because
yes.
of the abortions that are being performed. Why do you think God singled out those people who live on the banks of the rivers that have flooded?
Well, I think that it's just the first call, Terry. I think this is the first blast of the trumpet. We are going to see this country enter into the next millennium in convulsions. Our cities are going to be ravaged. What we saw in Los Angeles is just the beginning. We are going to have more and more severe weather patterns hit us. We're going to see an economic collapse that is going to produce mayhem for millions of people unless we repent. The bottom line is there are 30 million children who have been killed and their blood right now is crying out from the ground for vengeance to Almighty God. And God is slow to wrath, but once he begins to move in judgment, he won't relent. And I can tell you that God has 100 hurricanes and 100 droughts and 100 floods and 100 terrorists at his disposal. I believe even that the recent beginning stages of terrorism against our nation are the judgment of God against us. It's like God saying, okay, look, you want to terrorize babies in the womb? I'm going to let you taste what terrorism really feels like.
When you say that the floods are a result of God's wrath because of abortion, does that mean that the people who are suffering in the floods now are more responsible for abortions being performed, or are they just getting an unlucky break here?
This is the horrifying nature of sin and judgment. For example, if a man commits adultery and leaves his wife becomes destitute, his children grow up fatherless, they suffer because of his sin. And the bottom line is, sometimes when God judges a nation, innocent people who are not guilty of the sin that brought the judgment suffer, which should make us not mad at God, but should make us mad at the people who have brought the judgment on us. When Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed by fire, there were little kids who were destroyed, but it was the raving homosexuals that brought the judgment down.
You come from a really interesting, paradoxical background. I mean, you have three aunts who are not only feminists, but have been involved in the birth control movement. And from what I've read, your mother and your three aunts each had pregnancies out of wedlock when they were teenagers.
Yeah, I'm the pregnancy that my mom had.
Right. You're the pregnancy that she had out of wedlock.
Well, I was conceived out of wedlock, but my dad and her ended up getting married. And I could have been a prime target for abortion, had abortion been legal.
Is that one of the reasons why you became an activist, thinking about that, thinking that if abortion were legal, maybe you wouldn't be alive?
No, that's not one of the reasons why I became an activist. It never really occurred to me until a few years ago. But nevertheless, that is true. I could have been a victim. My mom and dad say, no, absolutely not. We would have gotten married. But I've been around too long. I've seen too many young people who at first, when they find out they're pregnant, say, well, let's get married, and then the pressure begins. Then the in-laws, then the friends, then the parents all start saying, you're too young, this will ruin your life, just one little procedure and it'll all be better. And, of course, we have to ask ourselves, how many precious little boys and girls who would have grown up into good, decent citizens have been brutally murdered and put in garbage dumps and dumpsters and sewers? How many children are gone? We know 30 million, maybe 35, maybe 40. Maybe we'll never know.
Let me ask you, I know you feel that if your mother had an abortion that you wouldn't be alive. And you're always thinking in those terms about people. If somebody had an abortion, this life wouldn't exist. I know that you don't believe in sex before marriage. I mean, you could say that if your parents didn't have sex before marriage, you wouldn't have been alive either. But
isn't the providence of God an amazing thing?
So you mean you condone sex before marriage if
no.
It results in your birth?
No, not at all. It's one of those mysteries. You just look at the grand spectrum of things. God is on his throne. If you look at the genealogy of Christ in the Bible, there are people in his genealogy who, well, if morals were being obeyed the way they should have been, those people would not be in the genealogy of Christ. And yet, they are part of his lineage. So God can work all things together for his good. Maybe if my mom and dad had just done the honorable thing, and that was wait until they got married. They were engaged. What they should have done was just waited until they got married. And then I would have been here, or someone else like me would have been here. These things are a mystery to us.
You ran away from home when you were 16. Why did you run away from home?
I wanted to leave. I was a rebel. I was obviously not a Christian at the time. I was not brought up in a Christian home. And I was a rebel. I wanted to leave. I quit school and I left.
What did you want to do?
What did I want to do? I was a guitar player and an organ player, and I wanted to play rock and roll.
Who were your influences? What bands did you want to be like?
Oh, good grief. Led Zeppelin, Kiss. Who else was I listening to back then? The Beatles, intensely.
Have you come to think of Led Zeppelin and Kiss as the devil's music now?
Well, I don't know what the devil listens to in hell, but I can assure you the lyrics of those bands, not the music per se, but the lyrics, the message of those bands is definitely devilish, hedonistic, abusive of women. So certainly it's evil, sinister, and some of it I would certainly think is demonically inspired.
You've spoken several times in this interview against homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Have you always spoken out against homosexuality in public forums before, or is it more recently that you've been speaking about homosexuality as well as abortion?
No, I've always spoken out against it in public forums, but a recent addition to my menu is that I've actually mobilized protests against homosexuals in the military. You will recall at the beginning of January that there was a whole bunch of cities around the country that had a Just Say No to Homosexuals in the Military campaign. Well, I was a part of putting that together. And the reason, of course, being is that homosexuality is an abomination. They are recruiters of children. They do not reproduce. So they are forever trying to recruit, especially young children. And it's a criminal behavior that must be stopped. We will not equate their vulgar lifestyle and all of their vulgar sexual practices. I mean, let's remember, this is not two guys holding hands and kissing each other on the cheek. These are acts that are too vulgar to describe. We are not going to put their vulgar lifestyle on par with normalcy, with the family, or with things that are good and pure and upright.
You're very confident that you are carrying out God's word and that other people don't quite get what God really means. Have you had visions of God coming to you and kind of telling you what to do?
No, I just read the Bible. I even though I was trained in a public school, I still understand phonetics. I can still read. And the Ten Commandments are very clear. The book of Deuteronomy, the book of Exodus, the books of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're very, very clear. And what we've got in this day is people who just don't want to read their Bible. Or they want to say that God is tolerance. God accepts all things equally. And that's just not true. God is love. It's amazing that he would send Jesus Christ to die for us and that we could be forgiven of our sins and become Christians and followers of Christ. But he also sends us to hell if we don't believe in Jesus, if we don't follow God, if we disobey his commandments.
So you're not worried about tolerance? Cause...
Intolerance is a beautiful thing.
Intolerance?
Intolerance is a beautiful thing. I mean, let's think about it. Susan B. Anthony was intolerant of only men voting. Martin Luther King Jr. was intolerant of segregation. Lech Walesa was intolerant of communism. George Washington was intolerant of British troops and King George.
I think you're using the word a little differently than
a beautiful thing.
Randall, I think you're using the word a little differently than it's commonly used for.
Well, I make no bones about it. There are people that are politically correct that want to say that the cardinal sin of the hour is intolerance. And I think that's a bunch of junk, and I want people to feel good about intolerance. As long as they're intolerant of something that is evil, not intolerant of, say, a race or a gender.
Randall Terry, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thanks for having me.
Randall Terry is the founder of Operation Rescue. He's written a book called Why Does a Nice Guy Like Me Keep Getting Thrown in Jail? This is Fresh Air. A peace agreement has been reached on the Balkans. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll have details from Geneva. There is an agreement for a union of the republics of Bosnia, that's what they're calling it, that has been reached in Geneva. Alija Izetbegović, Bosnia's president, says the deal must be approved by his political leaders back home. Deborah Amos tells us about the woman who is Turkey's new prime minister. Marjorie's son has the background on the man who is going to be Japan's new prime minister. Also, I'll have a conversation with Calvert DeForest, the New York actor who plays Larry Bud Melman on the David Letterman television show. That show moves to CBS, and NBC says he can't take that name.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last year, the Irish rock band U2 toured the world with its so-called Zoo TV tour, giving concerts designed to make ironic fun of its long-standing image as self-serious rock icons. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the band's new album, Zooropa, continues this process with healthy results.
On Zooropa, the most pretentious band of the 80s has become one of the 90s more tolerable superstar acts. Having spent the last decade setting themselves up as rock's ultimate seekers after the truth, U2 is finally pondering their flaws and frustrations.
Some days are dry, some days are leaky. Some days come clean, other days are sneaky. Some days take less, but most days take more. Some slip through your fingers and onto the floor. Some days you're quick, but most days you're speedy. Some days you use more force than is necessary. Some days just drop in on us. Some days are better than others. Some days it all adds up, and what you got is enough. Some days are better than others.
There are moments on Zooropa when the words sung by lead vocalist Bono are heavy with regret, exhaustion, and self-doubt. And that's on the more energetic tunes. The band rarely sounds like a mere quartet here. The music is thick with layers of guitar, synthesizer, and drum tracks. The melodies tend to fold in on themselves, avoiding the sort of sing-along anthems the band used to devise to rouse the thousands who attend their stadium shows. Zooropa offers U2 as perverse imps, intent on unsettling their audience. On a song called The Wanderer, they even gave Bono the day off and handed the singing chores over to Johnny Cash.
I went out walking through streets paved with gold. Lifted some stones, saw the skin and bones of a city without a soul. I went out walking under an atomic sky, where the ground won't turn and the rain it burns like the tears when I said goodbye. Yeah, I went with nothing, nothing but the thought of you. I went wandering.
U2 used to invoke blood-red skies and unforgettable fires, murmuring complaints like, I still haven't found what I'm looking for, with a piousness in search of revelation. By contrast, Zooropa is gratifyingly mundane, asserting only that some days are better than others and that one shouldn't expect too much. By downsizing their expectations, they sound human for the first time in their career.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
I don't know you, but you don't know the half of it. And a star in Rome, I was the bad guy who walked down. They say be careful where you aim, 'cause where you aim you just might.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's been said that Sandra Bernhardt is one of the few people who can make David Letterman blush. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to the provocative comedian and actress. Bernhardt has a new book called Love, Love, and Love. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.